Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk, featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. With very little violence in his past, mental health professionals would agree that the two-day killing spree of Daniel Gonzalez had occurred without warning. But in the days leading up to this massacre, they would miss one last chance to stop him forever. Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that, no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 137, Daniel Gonzalez, The Lost Boy, Part 3. Today, I'm standing on Makepeace Avenue in Highgate Hill, N5, 30 miles northeast of Daniel's home in Knapp Hill, more than 70 miles north of the attacks on Peter King and Marie Harding on the south coast, 4.5 miles southwest of the butchering of Kevin Malloy, and 3 miles southwest of the assault on Kumas Constantino. Coming imminently to Murder Mile. Makepeace Avenue on the Holly Lodge estate was built in the early 1920s, originally as housing solely for single women working in the city. Whereas now, it is a pleasant mix of private and council-owned semi-detached houses and mansion blocks, maintained by the community and Camden Council. With many of the buildings constructed in a uniform design of gabled roofs, red tiles, white wattle and daub and black timber frames. Blessed with stunning views of the city, it's a nice place to live. Here you might expect to hear the soft shush of a milk float, the polite chatter of a friendly postman, and the delicate snip of gardening shears. Nothing offensive or foul. At worst, you might witness a dog enthusiastically yapping for treats, an erroneous bit of litter in the wrong recycling bin, or, cor-lummy, a mild outburst of some F and Jeff as a retired accountant incorrectly fills in his crossword, or the chairwoman of the WI discovering that her buns have come out a little bit black about the edges. But you wouldn't expect to find a happily married and loving couple, brutally murdered in their own home. 2 days before the first murder, an attempted murder, Daniel suffered a major psychotic event, which should have been the overriding catalyst to get him the help that he needed, or to cut his bloody rampage dead in its tracks. But like so much of his mental health history, it was dismissed as irrelevant. And yet it was here, on Friday the 17th of September 2004, at 8 a.m, that Daniel would kill Derek and Jean Robinson. But so horrifically sadistic was their slaughter that it led a court of law to believe that Daniel wasn't just sick, but a psychopath, hell-bent on bloodlust.
I should be locked up. I should go to the electric chair for what I've done. If I had done that to myself, stabbed myself up, there would not be a problem.
At a little after 4:30 a.m, Kevin Molloy lay collapsed on the desolate pavement to the side of Tottenham High Road. Discovered 70 minutes after the attack, by the time that a doctor had declared Kevin as dead, with his kill count and frenzied bloodlust unsated, Daniel was already seeking his next victim. Only as before, his movements lacked clarity and his decision-making was muddy. If he had headed north, south or east, this heavily armed man would have encountered supermarkets, churches, cafes, car parks and stations. If inflicting a maximum casualty count was really his mission, trapped inside a bus, a train or a tube, with hundreds of commuters, he could have unleashed a truly horrific attack. But he didn't. Instead, he headed west, past the Swan pub where Kevin supped his last pint, and along Phillip Lane, a small road dotted with residential houses and industrial units. If attacking lone strangers was his mission, whether factory workers changing shift or postmen on their rounds, this place was perfect. But again, he didn't. Instead, he ignored it all and strolled 1.5 miles southwest to Frobisher Road in Hornsey. And somewhere along this route, whether at Tottenham Green, Duckett's Common, or Downhill Park, he dumped the knives. With no disguise, no weapons, no map, and having previously attacked lone people in isolated places, for no reason whatsoever, everything which had worked would cease. Friday the 17th of September 2004. Day 2. Victim 4. By now, the dawn had broken as Daniel walked into Green Lanes, a junction off Turnpike Lane Tube, packed full of residential houses and several local shops. The streetlights were off, the newsagents were opening, and the slow roar of traffic had begun to swell as a low sunrise illuminated its length. As his body count rose, this wannabe serial killer was getting into his stride with a tried and trusted method to his murders. He crept quietly from behind. He slit their throat with a sharp knife. He inflicted several hard, fast stabs, and then he fled. Only now, all of that would change, and no one knew why. At 6:50 a.m, he entered Frobisher Road, one of 20 identical residential streets with long lines of red and brown brick terraces, dotted with parked cars, tiny gardens, and wheelie bins. fitted with UPVC doors and windows. They were secure, but not impregnable, for a convicted burglar like Daniel. With the street's residents beginning to wake, he slipped off Frobisher Road, down Harringay Passage, a thin shadowy alley running beside their back gardens. Here he spotted an unlit house. He climbed over a tall fence, smashed a glass window pane to a silent kitchen, and broke into a family's home as they slept. The family were Kumas and Christella Constantino, a loving couple who lived with their elderly mother and their two little babies, who were fast asleep in a crib. Daniel didn't know their names, and he didn't care. To him, they were just numbers, notches on a scoreboard, and one step nearer to his place in infamy. With his heart pounding, gripping a stolen 8-inch kitchen knife in his sweaty palm, as the drip, drip, drip of four sinister voices supposedly guided his sadistic deeds, with five sleeping victims trapped inside a locked house, here he could kill with impunity. As from downstairs, he stalked, he was silent, and then he was struck. Having heard breaking glass and creeping feet, still dressed in just their pajamas, Kumas and Christella spotted the knife-wielding assailant in their downstairs corridor and sprang into action. Fueled by a fire to defend their loved ones at any cost, although unarmed, Kumas grabbed a pink baby cradle and started whacking Daniel over the head as the knife was plunged into the helpless man's arm and chest. Kumas would later state, "The cradle fell down. He tried again to stab me. I grabbed him by the hand and he bit me." But having only ever attacked easy targets, the elderly, the frail, the vulnerable and the drunk, Daniel was unprepared for the couple's onslaught. As Kumas would state, "I bit him on the neck." And to defend her bleeding husband, Christella fought back with whatever she had, later stating, "I got my slippers, and I hit that man with my slippers." It may seem pretty silly, but it was enough. So as Christella ran out the front door, screaming at the top of her lungs, she woke the neighbours, alerted the police, and Daniel fled. Kumas survived with only minor injuries, and Christella was shaken up. But owing to their courage, their family was safe. As with the attack on Peter King, this was another failure for the wannabe serial killer. He was easily overpowered, and with no mask or gloves, his face was seen, and he had left behind his fingerprints. Saturday the 11th of September 2004, 4 days before his killing spree, Daniel went to a rave in Hackney, East London, where he sunk a mind-bending cocktail of speed, ecstasy, LSD, cannabis and ketamine, all washed down with great glugs of spirits and energy drinks, as his battered body and brain was repeatedly assaulted by doomcore music. Many mental health professionals had diagnosed Daniel as in the grip of a drug-induced psychosis. Which makes sense, as with so many illicit stimulants, psychotropics and sedatives fighting in his own system, side effects could include paranoia, anxiety and depression, as well as auditory and visual hallucinations, which can mirror and mask schizophrenia or any number of personality disorders. Kill them. Kill them all. Sunday the 12th of September 2004. 3 days before his killing spree. Daniel returned to his home in Knapp Hill. Being exhausted and dehydrated, he did very little except rest, as he was physically and mentally spent. And although he slept solidly for the rest of the day, the drugs were still active. Monday the 13th of September 2004, 2 days before his killing spree. The time was 8:10 a.m. as Leslie's partner, Stephen Harper, sat in his car on their drive at Southwood Avenue. He would state, "I was just rolling a cigarette. And the next thing I knew, Daniel sprinted past me without any clothes on. Only he wasn't streaking for kicks and giggles, as darting past filling schools and rush hour traffic, this stark naked man with terrified eyes ran like he was being chased by the devil himself." Two police officers, PC Fellows and Rowley, were dispatched, but along with Stephen Harper, they were unable to locate Daniel anywhere in the village. Returning to Southwood Avenue, I opened the front door. I knew he was home because I could see him through the living room window. I could see him pacing up and down. I walked in and there was no sound. He'd obviously heard me come in and it all went quiet. I said, "Daniel, I've been looking for you in Knapp Hill." He said, "I wasn't in Knapp Hill, man." In a really strange voice that I'd never heard before, I could just sense that something wasn't quite right. So far, Daniel hadn't hurt anyone except himself. Daniel would later state,
"That morning, I was punching myself in the face, trying to give myself black eyes. I tried to break my nose by jumping face down onto the dustbin, and I threw myself down the stairs about 3 or 4 times. I was going mad. I've never been that ill before. I think it was a mode of self-harm. I wanted to degrade myself. I don't know why I did it, to be honest. I've absolutely no idea."
Concerned for his stepson's well-being, Stephen went to Woking Police Station to report the incident and to set the wheels in motion of a mental health intervention, as Daniel was unable to tell fact from fantasy or truth from lies. Stephen said, "I thought if I go down there, they'll take me more seriously." But the police's powers were limited. No officers attended, and the police receptionist's notes went missing. Even Daniel would later admit,
"I was running around the estate naked, and I didn't get arrested. That would have easily prevented those crimes from happening, because I was in a very bad way."
As quick as she could, Leslie arrived home. Daniel had done well over the last 6 months, staying at home and keeping out of trouble. But this was the worst she had seen him for nearly 6 months. And it had been 2 months since his last psychiatric assessment, where the doctor had described him only as okay and fine. Inside, the kitchen was strewn with knives, one of which, a 5-inch steak knife, would be used to brutally stab Marie Harding to death. And although, as Leslie would state, "I didn't know something was going to happen, but I was scared." For too many years, being bounced between specialists, every time we asked for help, or Daniel did himself, we would have to wait for a crisis to occur. Finally, a crisis had occurred. Her boy was sick and a danger to himself. So Leslie thought, this is the crisis. Now they have got to help. But after three attempts to call the duty social worker, who was described as indifferent and passive, Leslie was told to assess her son and to contact her local psychiatric hospital if she felt in any danger. Had he been assessed and sectioned by a professional, a tragedy could have been averted. Tuesday, the 14th of September 2004, one day before his killing spree. Being physically, mentally, and emotionally exhausted, Daniel spent the day in bed.
I had a really rubbish life, and I wanted to take it out on someone else.
And that's as far as his planning went. Wednesday, the 15th of September 2004. Day 1. Peter King and Marie Harding. Friday, the 17th of September 2004. Day 2. Kevin Malloy and Kumas Costantino. With a tally of 2 dead and 2 injured, the 50-50 hit rate of this wannabe serial killer was at best mediocre. So still fuming from a second failed attack, in which his neck was bitten and his head was beaten with a pink baby cradle and a pair of lady slippers, Daniel hopped in a taxi to Highgate Cemetery. Having fled Frobisher Road at 7 a.m, this 3.8 southwesterly journey took 20 minutes. And having asked for directions to the Holly Lodge estate, he arrived by foot at 7:45 a.m. But why did he come here? At 7:50 a.m, Daniel was witnessed on Makepeace Avenue, randomly pressing buzzers on a block of flats. But no one called the police. At one residence, an elderly lady opened the door and saw a young man with a large knife in his hand. But he didn't attack her. Being frail, vulnerable, and alone, she was perfect. But maybe the voices said no. Or maybe one more victim just wasn't enough. Friday, the 17th of September 2004, at 8 a.m. Day 2. Victims 5 and 6. Derek and Jean Robinson were the epitome of good, decent people who had dedicated their lives to helping disadvantaged children. As a highly regarded pediatrician and lecturer in children's health, Derek had worked in many war-torn and famine-riddled countries like Nigeria and Uganda, while Jean had worked as a communications officer for Christian Aid. To say that they cared about their fellow man would be an understatement. In 1994, after more than 40 years enriching people's lives, they both retired. But as humanitarians who had charity in their blood, being unable to rest with so much horror in the world, Jean taught music to underprivileged children, and Derek volunteered for the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture, working with teenage Iraqi asylum seekers who had been traumatized by the war. In 1999, they moved into 24 Makepeace Avenue. And although private, they quickly became a key part of the estate. Derek was a steady voice in the Holly Lodge Community Association. Jean drove the elderly to lunch clubs and bingo, and they were both active in their local neighborhood watch scheme. By 2004, Derek and Jean Robinson were enjoying the retirement they had earned. They had two daughters and several granddaughters. And so beloved were the Robinsons that upon hearing the news of their deaths, many of their neighbours and friends needed counselling from a local priest. But Daniel didn't know any of this, and he didn't care. As to him, they were just numbers. At 8 a.m, Derek and Jean sat eating breakfast. The morning was bright and warm. Abruptly, the doorbell rang. This was unexpected, but not a worry, as although the decorator was due about now, trusting him with his own key, he usually let himself in. But maybe he had misplaced it. With their kitchen out back, Derek got up and walked along the hallway towards the dark green door. Its small window pane frosted for privacy, but through it, he could see the familiar silhouette of a man. Only this was not the decorator, but Daniel, with a blade in his fist, and at least two more people to kill. With his heart pounding, a 12-inch knife in his palm, and the drip, drip, drip of four sinister voices goading him to fulfill his goal. As Derek unlatched the lock, from behind the door, Daniel stood. He was silent. And then he struck.
I remember thinking, ready, steady, go. And then I jumped up. I stuck it all the way in. It was such a long knife. There was no chance for the poor guy. I stabbed him once, and then I stabbed him again. I wanted to kill him quickly, so I stabbed him in the throat.
So fast and savage was the attack that he didn't even have time to defend his face, his neck, or his chest. Dashing to her husband's aid, as hard as Jean fought, this unarmed woman was no match for a knife-wielding psychopath who repeatedly stabbed her with every ounce of force.
The woman was really strong. I started feeling really sorry for her. I got the knife and then I went right through her throat and stabbed her loads of times in the heart because I wanted her to die quickly.
So frenzied were their deaths that the hall's walls were splattered to head height with their blood. And in the attack, even Daniel had sliced open his arm and his leg. And having spent their lives living side by side, together, Derek and Jean would die. Four people were now dead. Only this time, Daniel didn't flee.
As soon as I got in there, I actually stood and had a breather. And I thought, okay.
Inside his victim's home, safe behind the thick brick walls and locked doors,
I felt clean, orgasmic. I'd washed all the rubbish out of my life. I felt better. It is something I live for. It's a really good buzz. Killing.
At that moment, so sated was Daniel's bloodlust that he stripped naked in the kitchen. Unperturbed by the two bodies near his feet and their still warm blood oozing between his fingers, that he decided to take a shower. At 8:05 a.m, using his own key, the decorator let himself in. Inside, he witnessed the bodies, the blood, and a half-naked man who shouted,
"Sorry about this, mate,"
as he fled out of the back door. The police were alerted, and paramedics attended. But for these two pillars of the community, it was too late. at 8:10 a.m. Daniel caught the 214 bus at the Oxshott Avenue stop on Highgate West Hill. Heading south. For almost 20 minutes, he sat quietly and patiently. Among the commuters, who were unaware of the atrocities that this clean-cut young boy had committed. At roughly 8:30 a.m, he returned to King's Cross Station. But he didn't head home, and he didn't collect his bag. Instead, he asked the station staff if they knew of a place where he could take a shower. As they didn't, he headed towards Soho, and armed with two more knives, for the next 4 hours, he vanished. Daniel was living his dream of being Freddy Krueger for the day. Just days earlier, he was a nothing, a nobody but a lost boy with a few morbid dreams.
I will be a serial killer.
But now, he was. In his disturbed little brain, the name Daniel Gonzalez would forever be hailed amongst the pantheon of British serial killers. With as many confirmed kills as Robert Black and Robert Maudsley, and one more than Peter Tobin, Stephen Griffiths, and Patrick McKay. Technically, he wasn't a serial killer, but a spree killer. But Daniel didn't care about such pedantry, as what he wanted was infamy. Across a 2-day killing spree, 2 people were injured, 4 were murdered, and many families, including his own, were destroyed. But had the authorities taken him seriously? If they had had him sectioned and treated as a mentally unwell man who was a danger to himself, a tragedy could have been averted. But having been ignored, death had returned to London, and one more life would be taken. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was part 3 of 4 of Daniel Gonzalez, The Lost Boy. As always, if you enjoyed that, there's some unscripted waffle and extra info about the case after the break. But before that, as all the big commercial podcasts love to do, here's the credits to the show. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself. It was edited by myself. Directed by myself. Produced by myself. The artwork was by myself. With all the sounds created by myself. Michael was also the runner, the T-boy and the fluffer. He was also the PR team, the marketing team, and he does all of the social media, the IT, and he handles all of the complaints. Yes, unlike those big corporate podcasts who are funded by broadcasters and networks, here at the end of each episode, you won't hear a long list of people who have collectively managed to churn out a whopping 6 episodes a year. 4! And for that, having paid iTunes a small fortune, they make it to the top of the podcast charts, having only released a promo. That's strange. Murder Mile is a one-man operation. Everything is created by myself, with just a laptop and a microphone, with which I keep you entertained across the year by churning out high-quality episodes every week. I don't compromise by hiring others. I will never let anyone else write or research an episode, and I will never outsource the edit to an external producer. As Murder Mile is my baby, and I feel that you deserve only my best. So to help this small independent podcast, you can write a glowing 5-star review. That's always nice. Share an episode with your chums on social media. That's very nice too. Or, and only if you can afford it, please sign up to Patreon, as even a $3 donation goes a long way. And for that, you get loads of goodies in return, as well as my thanks. A big thank you this week to my new Patreon supporters, who are Gary Gromowski-Cook, Lynn Domsala, Ragan Harald Nyland, Nolene Rankin, and Elizabeth Funden. I thank you, and I bless all of your little cotton socks. Even if they're not cotton, but a nasty polyester hybrid mix. Ugh. As mentioned, Murder Mile was researched, written and performed, and everything else by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
That was all right. That wasn't too bad. Wasn't horrific, even though we got a man outside who decided to do some mowing outside. Oh, Diet Coke time. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Extra Mile. That was all right. That wasn't too bad. I was trying not to overwrite it this time. It's a little bit longer than I would have liked, but sometimes I overwrite it and there's a lot of things that I can't pronounce, even though I've written it. And I go through all my script afterwards and I double check it. And in my head, I can read it. And then when I come to say it, it all goes tits. So even though in rehearsals, I can read it fine. Sometimes when I get to this bit, it just doesn't, my mouth doesn't want to work. And I don't know why. So, have I introduced us? I haven't. Welcome to Extra Mile. Of course, Extra Mile time. As mentioned earlier, this isn't compulsory. You don't have to listen to this bit. So if you're new to the podcast and you're thinking, what the hell is this? And you're thinking, oh, I don't like this. That's fine. You don't have to like this. I don't particularly like it myself. It's all right, but it's not the main part of the show, which is the part that you've just listened to. That's all hard work. That takes bloody ages. This bit takes nothing. Nothing. It's twaddle, but people love it, so I still do it. So yeah, there we go. So you don't have to listen to it. You can switch off now. That's not a problem at all. Thank you very much. Goodbye to everyone else. Whew, we're here. Right, I'm gonna open up the windows. I'm gonna get rid of. It's not warm today, but it's a bit foisty indoors. It's a bit foisty. So I'm just gonna open up the side windows. I locked it when I went out. Yes. Oh, so there we go. Hang on. Oh, just need a little bit of air. Otherwise, it is foisty. Cool. That's better. There we go. Open up these as well. There we go. Pop on the. I've already prepped my tea. I think. Hang on. Let me check. See, when I do things out of sequence. Yeah. When I do things out of sequence, I throw myself off. Right, yeah, as with last week, instead of me recording on a Thursday morning and then powering through and editing Thursday and cleaning, spending all day Thursday cleaning up the audio, Friday doing the edit, Saturday doing the edit, what I'm trying to do now is get myself ahead of the game so I'm I'm trying to make sure I'm all written and completed and rewritten by Wednesday lunchtime, and then I record and do a little bit of an edit on Thursday, and then that means I can do a little bit longer days Thursday, Friday, which means I can get Saturdays off or get myself ahead of the game, which is great, which I need to do because I got my eye specialist appointment coming up soon, so I need a whole day off for that, which would be good. And I've got my second COVID jab probably the day after this goes out, I think. If this goes out Thursday, yeah, next Friday. So I need to get myself ahead in case I'm sick. I probably won't be, but you never know. As was my tip last time, I got really... I did lots of cycling and I got really pissed. And that's... I didn't seem to notice if I got sick because I was too busy being tired and pissed. I cut my hand. And I've got a mate's birthday coming up as well. So I want to try and make sure I can get to that. Important news as an update from last week, as I would have mentioned last week, my walking tours are completing at the end of this year. I'm kind of wrapping up the tours. It's kind of been a hard time for tourism, but I'm trying to wrap it all up now. So I've emailed a lot of people who have valid vouchers already and who currently have tickets that need to be reassigned and things like that. But if you have vouchers that you haven't used yet, there's multiple options that we can do. Right, so this is really important. Obviously, we've still got tours going along to the end of the year. So if you can do, please book on a Murder Mile tour. Even if your voucher has expired, just email me. That's fine. I will tweak your voucher, and therefore you can use that into any tour up until the end of the year. So it'd be lovely to see you then. If you can't attend one of the tours, but you know someone who kind of lives in London or the UK and would like the tour, or you think, you know, you're thinking, oh, it's birthdays, I can't be asked to buy them a present, I'll just donate them. I can reissue that ticket to them. That's not a problem. So, yeah, just email me as well and say, I want to donate this ticket to my friend. This is their email address. I can do that. That's not a problem at all. Third option that we can do, if you can't go on the tour and you don't want to donate your ticket to anyone, what you can do is just say to me, can you donate the money to charity? What I'm going to do is, for all of the tickets that aren't used at the end of the year, when Murder Mile is all, where the, just the tours are all wrapped up, what I'm going to do is I'm going to donate all that money to St Mungo's, which is the homeless charity, which provides accommodation and food and clothing for homeless people in the West End, which is a fantastic charity. So I pay a little bit of transaction costs on it. So if you've bought a ticket that's £15, at least £12 of that will be going to charity. Unfortunately, a percentage of it is transaction fees, which I pay. Which comes out of my end of it. But the rest of it I will donate to charity. So that would be a nice thing to do. What else? I can give you a refund. That's not a problem as well. With that, you get a full refund. If you can only get a refund back to the credit card or debit card that was used to buy those tickets. I can't transfer the money to someone else. The system doesn't work that way. The money can only go back to the person who bought the tickets. Or there's another option, which is, the kettle's about to brew. Let's do this and I'll do option five. There we go. Water in. Really did. I keep cutting my finger on my soundproofing thing because it's got a nut that's a bit annoying, and I scrape my fingers along. It's horrible. Anyway, number five. Came to me during the week. I've already made some people aware of this. Before all this COVID horribleness happened, I originally was going to do a kind of special tours for not like the regular Murder Mile tours that I do, but kind of the for people who like listening to this podcast. And I'd already kind of half set it up, but then the pandemic happened and I shut it down. I forgot that I'd done it. So that's the new idea. So December the 12th will be the last Murder Mile walk. So I won't be doing any more after that. Some of those stories might get cannibalized into the new Murder Mile series, which would be nice. But what I'll do on an ad hoc basis kind of in 2022, so next year, I'll do a series of walks. The great thing is they're not. I'm not going to pre-plan them. I'm not going to script them. Therefore, I don't have to rehearse. They're not going to be on a regular basis. They might be once a month or every 6 weeks. Because my plan is next year is to travel around on the boat and move around the country. But because I need to be back in London at least once a month to check my post and go to my doctors, my eye specialist and visit mates and things like that, I'm going to be in London anyway. So I thought to myself, let's have some fun. So I will do a tour for like, don't know, 20 people, you know, 30, don't know, whatever. And the idea is, if you like, if you watch Murder Mile, basically we'll meet up, we can have a chat. It's very kind of improvised kind of idea. What we'll do is, I could take you on tours of all the murder locations. We can have a chat. We can kind of, you know, maybe I might have some pictures with me. I haven't quite decided yet. But the idea is, we just have a bit of fun. And you know, you can guide me. You can say, oh, what about that episode? We can't do Ridge Christie, obviously, but because that's too far away. But anything that's kind of Soho, Mayfair, Fitzrovia, Piccadilly, St Giles, St Anne's, kind of, yeah, Bloomsbury, that kind of area. You know, within walking distance, we can kind of cover it in about 2 hours, have a bit of fun, maybe have a pint afterwards. And of course, everyone who attends the tour gets a nice little packet with loads of goodies in there, of Murder Mile goodies. So I thought that might be something nice to do. It's less stress for me and it's also a bit of fun. So I haven't set that up yet. That'll be something I'll organise in the year. But if you have a voucher for Murder Mile and you don't want to use it up, but you're thinking to yourself, I might come on the new Murder Mile walks in the new year, let me know. I'll put you on a kind of a list, and then when I'm launching that, I'll just send you a ticket and that'll all be good. Right, let's go and grab me tea. I've got my Diet Coke here, but I'm going to grab me tea and put my fake milk in. Fake milk time! Oh yeah! Life is good with fake milk. Leave that there, let it dump. Oh, hard life this. I'm exhausted today because obviously it was Eva's birthday yesterday. Oh, tired. I bought her 26,452 presents. She's a little bit annoyed with me because it wasn't enough. You know, she's high maintenance, is Eva. She likes lots of presents. And 26,000 wasn't enough. Oh, dear. How can that woman have so many pairs of shoes? Anyway, let's do some questions for the quiz. Oh, just to say in this episode, just in case there's any pedants out there, two things I'm going to point out. So in the episode, I make reference to Kumis Constantiano. Now, I know that his name is Zumis. I'd actually made a note, because every time someone's name is on there that I can't pronounce, I always kind of double check how it's pronounced. And then I put a little note to myself. But when it got to this episode, I was like, ah, shit, I had already previously checked that his name wasn't Kumis, it was Zumis, Zumus, as it's actually pronounced. But in episodes 1 and 2, I'd already called him Kumis, and I'd already launched them, so I thought, do you know what, fuck it. I will just, pardon the language there, I will just stick with the pronunciation that I've done in parts 1 and 2, and also it stops the pedants getting in touch, going, oh, Zumis, as people do. Also, some people may come back to me and they'll go, oh, you misspelled the name Gonzalez. I think you'll find if you check the Daily Mail, his name is Gonzalez. Gonzalez. Actually, his name isn't spelled Gonzalez. It's actually spelled E-S. I've checked this multiple times on his medical records, on his birth certificate, the inquest into his own details and all the letters from his doctors as well. His name and his father's name is spelled Gonzalez. But everyone else, on every documentary and every article, including all the newspapers, have misspelled it. They've spelled it with an S, and that's wrong. So I'm sticking with the correct spelling. And if anyone comes back to me and goes, I think you'll find... I love when people do that, when they send me an email going, I think you'll find... I hate to point it out, but I think you'll find. If you start an email with the words, I think you'll find, I think means I don't know. So therefore, what you're saying is, I don't know, but... It's what ignorant people write. Anyway, let's do the quiz. Yummy. Ooh, exciting. And, oh, what have I just done with my cake? This is... in Morrison's the other day, I was like, because I'm nearer Morrison's. It's not the best Morrison's. It's nice inside, but it's It looks like Russia in the 1980s. It's like you come along some shelves, it's so badly stocked, and you come along and there's some shelves and there's like one potato. It literally is that. Anyway, yesterday they managed to do some bloody donuts for once. They hadn't got the chocolate ones. I've just bought some custard ones. Ooh, delicious. Got those. But they were doing chocolate and orange donuts. Ooh, so I've got one of those to eat. Yummy. Right, Michael, let's do the quiz. What I'm thinking about doing for this improvised tour as well, I'm thinking about doing a quiz in there as well. This is just an idea at the moment, having a bit of fun with the tours, not making it so stressful that I have to memorise things and it's all complicated. I just want it to be fun. So the idea is have a bit of a quiz and the winner wins a Murder Mile mug. All good. So you'll do the tour, but at the same time, you've got to kind of be on your toes as well. So question number one. What was the name of the road that Kumis or Zumis and his family lived on? So what was the name of the road that Zumis and his family lived on? Question number two. What did Zumis, see I'm using his proper name here, what did Zumis hit Daniel with? So what did Zumis hit Daniel with? I love these details. Question three. What did his wife, Christella... I hate that people do that. They write Zumis and his wife. But so we can differentiate between them, I'm writing his wife. What did his wife, Christella, hit Daniel with? What did she hit Daniel with? That was the question. Question four. Where was Zumis stabbed? Question five. How did Daniel break his nose? Question six. What was Daniel's stepfather doing when he saw him running naked? Question seven. Which countries did Derek Robinson work in? Apart from England, obviously. Question eight. Derek and Jean did what as jobs? Question nine. Where did Daniel get out of the taxi near Derek and Jean's home? So when Daniel was heading to Derek and Jean's home, where did he get out of the taxi? This end one is a hard one. Right, strap in. Question 10. What number bus did Daniel get from Makepeace Avenue? He was actually from Oxshott Avenue, but when he was leaving Derek and Jean's, what number bus did he get? Okay, right. Done 15 minutes on that. Let's try not to do too much on this. Ooh, look at that donut. Maybe a day to 2 days old, but who cares? I'm going to wolf that down. So let's dive into some details. Let's dive into Daniel's kind of breakdown. On Monday the 13th of September 2004. So I used a lot of these quotes in there. Daniel said, "That morning I was punching myself in the face trying to give myself black eyes. And I did have one black eye. I was just going mad. I've never been that ill before, not even when I committed my offences. I think it was a mode of self-harm, but in a different type of way. I wanted to degrade myself, self-degradation to feel better. That's why I did what I did. I don't know why I did it, to be honest. I have absolutely no idea." I'm not going to go into some details because some of these details are questions. He said, "Before I committed the offences, I was seen running around Knapp Hill Estate completely naked, round the shops, past all the pubs and everything. Don't forget, this was all the kids were going in school, everyone was heading to work. Ran back down the road, all the estate, I was completely naked." Let's miss Stephen Harper's quote. No, we'll use that. His stepfather said, "I got into my car, I heard movements upstairs. I knew Daniel was awake. I sat in my car..." doing something that is one of the questions. "And the next thing I..." See, I'm getting better at this. "And the next thing I knew, Daniel came running up the drive, sprinting past me without any clothes on. This was approximately 8:10 in the morning. There were quite a few schools where I live, so there were people about and it was quite a busy time. I thought I would drive to see where he was going and what was going on. I couldn't find him. I drove around the village for a bit and then I phoned Leslie at work, who's Daniel's mum, and she said to go and check if he's back home. Now, there were several reports to the police that morning of a naked man running around Knapp Hill. Two police officers have mentioned PC Fellows and Rowley were dispatched and they called a Nap Hill at just after 8 a.m, so probably about 10 past as mentioned. So not long afterwards, both officers were unable to locate Daniel. His dad couldn't locate him as well, so no one really knew where he had went. At that point, they didn't know that it was Daniel Gonzalez. They just were aware that there was a naked man running around. What else we got? As mentioned, Stephen made it back home because Leslie was like, maybe he's probably come home. He said, I went back, opened up the front door, and I knew he was at home because I could see through the living room window. I could see him pacing up and down. I walked in and there was no sound at all. He had obviously heard me come in, and it went quiet. I said, Daniel, I've been looking for you in Nap Hill. And he said, I wasn't in Nap Hill, man, in a strange voice that I've never heard before. I thought something's wrong here. I could just sense that something wasn't right. As mentioned, Steve and his stepfather decided to take him down to the police station. Obviously, if you take him down to the police station, you can kind of get what he was trying to do was get a mental health intervention in place and kind of, you know, because the police have, although they have limited powers, they have powers to kind of stop him, and under the Mental Health Act, they've got the powers to kind of take him to a hospital and things like that. So, you know, have him, the police have got the powers to kind of have him detained. But obviously, it's the mental health professionals who have the major power to be able to section him. But kind of, you know, Stephen and Leslie knew that this was kind of a key first step for them. Stephen said that he went to the police station expecting Daniel to be taken to hospital because of his mental state. This kind of thing had happened before. He hadn't run around naked, but it's kind of, you know, when Daniel has an episode, they're able to go to the police are able to section him. Stephen said he spoke to a receptionist at Woking Police Station. Her notes afterwards seemed to have gone missing. The report states that Mr. Harper refused to give his name and address as he did not want police involvement. Stephen disputes this. Surrey Police declined to comment on the report or its recommendation that reception staff should have bound books for note keeping. This is why the notes were missing, because it was on a scrap of paper as opposed to a bound book. So after that, as mentioned, Leslie's mother decided to call the duty social worker for the community mental health team. And she kept calling and calling, but just wasn't able to get through. Finally, she got through eventually and said, my son's running around the streets naked and he's jumping down the stairs and trying to see if he can break his nose. See, I'm being good. This is Daniel on this bit. He said, if I'm running around the estate naked, they should have acted. They didn't arrest him for that. They just kind of put it as, you know, he's unwell, he's gone home, everything should be okay now. What else do we got? We did the bits in the episode. So she came home and found knives strewn all around the kitchen. She tried to get several attempts to get someone to assess him, but she was told that she had to assess him himself, and then if she had a problem, she could take him to a local psychiatric hospital, which, as we've seen before, is always a problem because he tends to be treated as an outpatient when he's there, whereas what they wanted was him to be treated as an inpatient, to be taken in and assessed and to be sectioned. But they didn't, though. They would just take him to his an outpatient. He would be seen by a doctor, and the doctor, as we've seen before, would go, he's fine, he's okay, yeah, everything's all right. Because don't forget, Daniel's kind of moods shift all the time. Nothing is ever consistent, which is why they're unable to kind of pin down his diagnosis, because sometimes he's high mania, sometimes he's low, sometimes he's depressed, you know, it's all over the shop. Leslie contacted the mental health social worker. She said she described him as indifferent and passive. This made me perturbed and very angry. You know, everyone's kind of saying that if that social worker's attitude would have been different at that moment, then none of this really would have happened. But if you look at the past, even in the past, sometimes some people take him seriously, but some of the mental health professionals didn't take him seriously. The problem is, it's hard for them to work out as they said before, whether he really was a paranoid schizophrenic or, as the parole officer said, he's just a silly little boy. So that's the problem that's going throughout. There's no consistency in this at all. And that's the problem with mental health, really, is it's not, as I mentioned before, it's not like a broken leg. It's not consistent. You can't just look at it and go, there's the problem. You know, you have to take a lot on face value. You have to hope that people are doing their job properly. You hope that people have got the right expertise. And depending on whether they're drugs counsellors or psychiatrists or probation officers or whatever, everyone has a speciality. Therefore, if they don't know what's going on, they go back to default, you know. What else did we have? Let's look at Zoomus. So we don't really know what number on the road the attack happened. God damn it, I've searched, but I have not been able to find out exactly what number on the road they lived at. But given the fact that they probably still live there, I probably won't mention that anyway. If you look at the route from Tottenham Hale down to Zoomis's house and then to Derek and Jean's house, it literally is, it's southwest, it's literally a straight run all the way. Big boat going past, and unfortunately an annoying grey wide beam. Everywhere around here is just full of grey wide beams. It's just, oh, get paint your boat, make it nice. Oh, I don't mind if people have grey wide beams, that's fine, you're welcome to have one, but I just think if you're going to live on a boat, don't just have the basic undercoat colour. Jazz it up, make it look nice, decorate it yourself. I don't fucking care. Right. Oh god, you can tell, I'm either on sugar high or sugar low, one or the other. So yeah, this is really weird. So if this is the point where the story starts to really change, as we've seen, Daniel was murdering people or trying to attack them in isolated places, and then for no particular reason he turns to houses. He starts going to try and kill them inside houses, which doesn't make sense. Maybe it started because he didn't have knives, because don't forget he threw away the knives after the murder of Kevin Malloy. So he didn't have knives, so he needed knives. And where are you going to get knives? In people's houses. It was too early in the morning to go to shops. I've had a look, there's pretty much nothing open. There's nothing. The route he was taken down, there's kind of like convenience stores. That's pretty much all there is. Some couple of cafes, but even at that time in the morning, there wasn't much open. So if you need knives, where are you going to find them? Now, don't forget, he had a small history of burglary. He had one charge for burglary. We're not too sure how many burglaries he did. This was when he was younger and when he was homeless at the time, and he was kind of going through a bit of a drugs problem. So he was partially experienced at breaking into houses. Don't forget, it's not actually that difficult. It's kind of late summer, it's September. Most people probably have their windows open anyway. Or, as we all know, you can kind of jump. Even though people have locked their door, quite a lot of people leave their keys in the door. So it's not difficult to kind of break a little bit of a window, grab in, unlock the door, and you're in. But it was weird. Zoomis's house, he'd done no surveillance on that. We don't know why he was there. He seems to have picked this street at random. It's very weird why he chose that. But he got into the kitchen. He grabbed either one or some of their knives. We reckon it's some of their knives. And because we don't know exactly which address they lived at, what we do know is, because I looked at the maps, you can't get access to the back garden, which is where the kitchen is, by going in through the main road. So you have to go down Haringey Passage and either to Luzanne Road or Falkland Road, which is the roads on either side to gain access to the back garden. So we're not too sure which way he came in. What else is there? I think that's see, there's my note saying Zoomus. Michael. I think that's, I won't do too much on that because we've kind of done pretty much everything I put into that attack. That went into the episode, so I'm not going to really do too much. We know that he grabbed a taxi and headed towards Highgate. That's fine, it's not giving away the question. He would have still been splattered with blood of Kevin Malloy by that point, but don't forget it was early morning, so people may not have noticed. He was wearing jeans, they may not have noticed. So we don't know. Well, and obviously we don't know how bloodied he was. Don't forget, there's people kind of walking around in the mornings, heading off to work. And, you know, quite often I've seen kind of workmen going into town. They've got all manner of shit over their clothes. Because, you know, if you're a workman, what's the point in putting on a fresh pair of clothes if you're going to get them dirty again? So people may have just thought, you know, he was off to work. He's been out for the night having a bit of fun. So, you know, we don't really pay that much attention to people. So it's no surprising that people didn't really notice that he was covered in blood. Again, Derek and Gene Robertson, their address was really hard to find. I am listing what their address was there because they're both dead. Therefore, they're not still living there anymore. Well, that took a bloody long time to find that address because it was not listed anywhere. And I only found a couple of images of it online. And it's not covered by Google Maps because it's a private estate. But I was able to track it down. You're welcome. You're welcome. So what else? Just having a look to see if there's anything else that we really need to say about this. Many of these are already questions already, and we've already covered it in this episode. But they seem like really nice people. Derek and Jean seem really nice. They obviously worked really hard all of their lives. It was a nice house. It was a three-bedroomed house, pre-war, timber-fronted, semi-detached. Kind of had a little nice little set of steps going down, some trees in the front garden, a kind of an arch before you get in, so it's slightly shadowed on the door. Therefore, anyone coming towards the door would be just seen as a bit of a silhouette. That's why I like these little pictures, because they give me a bit of an insight and then I can think my way around it. As opposed to just writing what the press have done, what I try and do is I look at the pictures and I try and picture what they would see from the other end and what everyone sees and hears and thinks. And, you know, I think it just makes for a better episode rather than just saying the man walked down the street and then he got stabbed. Do you know? Anyway, I think that's it. I don't think I want to say any more. We used most of Daniel's quote in there where he said, ready, steady, go. And then I jumped up and stuck it all the way in, i.e. the knife. It was such a long knife. There was no chance for the poor guy. I stabbed him once and I stabbed him again. I wanted to kill him quickly, so I stabbed him in the throat. The woman was really strong and I started feeling really sorry for her. I went through her throat and I stabbed her loads of times in the heart because I wanted her to die quickly. Lovely. What a pleasant chap. These are all taken from the interviews that he gave at Holborn Police Station afterwards. Whereas with that, you know, he would have had a duty solicitor with him and he would have been told, you know, you're perfectly entitled to say no comment to everything, but he didn't. He just wanted to talk about it. This time the attack was done with a 12-inch knife. This would have been stolen from Coomis's house. Again, he wasn't wearing his Friday the 13th mask. That was back at his house with Marie Harding's DNA on it. He didn't have any other masks. He didn't seem to have a Freddy Krueger mask, which, you know, it seems weird that because he said, I won't be a Freddy Krueger for the day, and yet no one calls him the Friday the 13th killer. Because he was wearing a Jason mask. But then again, that's the way the press, especially the tabloids, work. Tabloids. What else we got? As mentioned, this is weird that he didn't run. This is weird because normally this was his thing, that he'd stab someone, then he'd run. Whether he didn't run because he was in the confines of someone else's house, or whether he didn't run because he was ecstatic, because technically he'd become a serial killer, we don't know. But it was in their house that he decided that he wanted to have a shower. So he was currently undressing in their kitchen when the decorator came in and disturbed him. What else was there? I'm just going through all my notes. There's loads of notes, but it's a lot of them that we've kind of already done. It was said, there's two different things that it is said that Daniel said to the decorator when the decorator came in and saw him kind of half naked and kind of surrounded by blood and dead bodies. Either Daniel said, sorry about this, mate, before fleeing, or he said, would you like a cup of tea? Or we could have said both. But we don't know which. So what I've opted for, sorry about this, mate, because it sounds nearer to what he said to Peter King when he was like, oh, sorry about this, I can't help it, I'm a schizophrenic. Do you know, it's more apologetic, whereas would you like a cup of tea just sounds stupid. Also, it reminds me of Reg, and I didn't want to confuse him. So I opted for the sorry about this, mate. What else we got? He dashed out through the back garden. A police helicopter was called, and it kind of scoured around Hampstead Heath and kind of 100 yards around the murder scene. Police described the suspect as white and in his 20s. What else? But obviously by that point he'd already got on the bus. No one had really noticed him, and he kind of disappeared. He wasn't really a kind of a fast getaway. He was kind of just on the bus, chugging along. It's stopping every 100 feet or so, as buses do. No one really noticed. We don't know much about the lady whose door he knocked on, the elderly lady. He knocked on her door, she opened the door, saw that he had a knife in his hand. For some reason he didn't kill her, and we don't know why. But then again, that's Daniel, isn't it? There's so many chances that he had to kill other people, and he didn't. He could have killed when he was on the bus going to King's Cross. He had knives on him. He'd just killed people. He was all pent up. He could have just... There probably was 30 people on the bus. He could have just stabbed them all on the bus. Then he would be one of Britain's biggest serial killers, or spree killers, but he didn't. So we don't know. We don't know what really was going on in his mind. Anyway... I think that's it. There's my little note that says, Michael, answer the question. So I'm going back. I'm going to answer the questions to the quiz. And then I'm going to have my donut. Ooh, check it out. I've also got awesome Kit Kats as well. Kit Kats! Okay, let's do answer to the questions. What was the name of the road that Zoomis and his family lived on? It was Frobisher Road. Question two. What did Zoomis hit Daniel with? It was a pink baby cradle. Question three. What did his wife, Christella, hit Daniel with? It was her slippers. It's an interesting note to go back. If you go back to the Trader and the Devil's Child episode, don't forget in there that we did a whole breakdown of different types of burglars. And there are different types, as mentioned. I think there was three types, and two of the key ones that were mentioned were opportunists and confronters. And it's interesting to see what Daniel is, because you would, given the fact that he's a bit of a coward when he's with a lot of the actions that he's doing, you would say that he's an opportunist, kind of the way he breaks into steal knives. But he's clearly a confronter on here. So I'd love to know more about what he did on the burglaries that he's committed. But unfortunately, we don't know much about that. Question four. Where was Zoomis stabbed? He was stabbed in the arm and the chest. Question five. How did Daniel try to break his nose? His own nose. He was jumping face first onto the wheelie bin. Question six. What was Daniel's stepfather doing when he saw Daniel running naked? Oh, got burpees. He didn't have burpees. He was rolling a ciggy, i.e. a cigarette. Question seven. I haven't had my tea yet. That's not the question. Question seven. Which countries did Derek Robinson work in? Excluding England. It was Uganda and Nigeria. Question eight. Derek and Jean did what as jobs? Derek was a paediatrician and Jean was a communications officer for Christian Aid and a music teacher. Question nine. Where did Daniel get out of the taxi near Derek and Jean's home? It is believed to be Highgate Cemetery. Which kind of makes sense, because that's really in that area, that's the only direction, that's the only kind of main thing in that area that you could kind of head towards. If you didn't know the area, that's where you would head to. Question 10. What number bus did Daniel get from Makepeace Avenue? He was on the 214 heading to Moorgate. Lovely. Well, that's that done. Hope you all enjoyed that. That was the end of Murdermar for this week. Obviously, we've got part four next week. And then after that, we go back to one-parters, which I'm looking forward to. Because, oh, these four-parters are a bloody nightmare to get your head around. But I'm enjoying them. Anyway, stay safe. Have yourselves a good week. Lots of love. Be good. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.